calendar, because we have Jewish holidays and they come out on different English dates. So we know there's the solar calendar, January, February, 365 days in a year. And then there's a lunar calendar, 354 days in a year. So different cultures, Muslims, I think the Chinese, different people follow lunar, different cultures follow the solar. So there's 11 day difference. So for instance, and most people just pick one, you either follow the solar or you follow the lunar. So let's take Muslims, for example. They have something called Ramadan. I don't know if you're familiar with the 30-day fast day. So when does it come out? Spring, winter, summer, or fall? I guess the answer is all of the above. Because I remember the first time I don't know if you watched basketball, but it was the NBA Finals, and they had this player, Hakeem Olajuwon, who became a born-again Muslim. And they said he was fasting today. And I'm wondering, I've been watching him for the past 5 years, he hasn't been fasting. And then I realized, oh yeah, it's a lunar calendar. So if you go by a lunar calendar, there are no seasons. Of course there are seasons, but the holiday isn't connected to a season. So Ramadan could come out, and it does. I didn't have to ask anyone, but I'm sure they like it better in the winter because they fast from sunrise to sunset. Sunset's a lot earlier in December than it is in June and July. It's also a little cooler, easier to fast. So nevertheless, they don't lock into a season. So I like to say semi-jokingly that people who follow a lunar calendar, they live longer in years, but not necessarily more minutes or hours, because if you have 11 days less a year, and you live to 100, what's 100 times 11? So they'll be much older. But I'm just kidding about that. So either way, it's a matter of how you count the years. So in Judaism, what do we follow? Lunar or solar? So the answer is both, but fundamentally lunar. In other words, the Jewish calendar is based on the lunar calendar. But the problem is, our holidays have to be in season. Passover has to be in this. Passover will go, the Exodus from Egypt, the Jews got free. That's when the nation began. So we'll go through the specific holidays in a minute. But all the holidays have to be, some have to be in the spring, fall, etc. So therefore, so what do we do then? You have a problem. Because if you follow a lunar calendar, it's going to be out of sync. So, well, it's already set up. I could just take out my calendar book and look what's going to be 100 years from now. But what do? They set up 7 times every 19 years. So a little less than every 3 years. We have a leap year. But there's a big difference between a leap year, a secular leap year, and a Jewish leap year. What do I mean there's a big difference? How many days is a civic leap year? When they have them, February 29th, one day. When we have a leap year, we had a whole month. We had 29 days. So therefore, 7 times every 19 years, we had an extra month. Why? So therefore, to ensure that the holidays always happen in the season. That's why, let's say the next holiday coming up will be the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah. This year, it's like mid-September. But sometimes it could be the beginning of September, or sometimes the end of September. So anytime it gets out of whack, so we have a leap year to make sure we get an extra month to make sure that every holiday comes in the right season. So we follow fundamentally lunar, but we also go with the solar as well, because we need to keep season. So why is it? Why do we do both? Why do we combine both the solar calendar and lunar? What's the philosophy? What's the theology behind it? So the solar calendar represents stability. In other words, sunrise, sunset. It's even a song. If you know where to look, you know where to find sunrise and sunset. Day in, day out, it doesn't change. Everyone needs stability in their life. You got to have a food to eat. You need a roof. You need a house to live in. You need clothes. You need the basics of life, no matter what. So that's the sun. The solar represents the everyday things. However, we all know if we do the same thing every day, life becomes boring and rote. So we gotta mix things up a bit and have some creativity in our lives. That's what the moon represents. Go, you could try it. Go out at night and try finding the moon. Half the month, it's not visible. And the other half, it's waxing bigger and smaller. I know when we're getting because I follow the lunar calendar, so I know on the 15th of the month is when you have the 15th of the Jewish month. So we're coming close. Yesterday will be the Jewish new month. So it's going to be this year, you know, sun. So it's coming up. So we're towards the end of the month on the lunar calendar. But I think I saw it nice and big last night. So it also depends if it's cloudy, this and that. So the moon represents change. So in addition, you need both in your life. Because if you do the same thing, whether it's eating, physical, spiritual, whatever it is, a person needs change. Because we're human beings. Like, for instance, I'll give a teaching example. You could apply it to PSW, nursing, it applies to anything in life. Since I'm a teacher, so I'll use that example. You notice some teachers, they're going 30 years, 40 years, and they're so excited. It's like the first day in class. And other teachers, after a couple of years, they're all like burnt out already. Obviously, there are many reasons, but one fundamental reason, why does someone remain excited and interested in others? Because if you're teaching a subject, so then, okay, how long could I teach 1 + 1 = 2? How long could I teach the same thing if I stop getting bored because I'm teaching a topic? But if you're teaching people, so then you never get bored because people are different. I could give the same orientation, but I have a different group every day, and everyone's going to ask different questions. You're going to listen differently. I'm going to say it over different. So if you're dealing same thing, we'll just use PSWs because that's what you are. But same thing, you're going to do this. You might be doing the same exact thing every day, you know, and helping the residents. Every resident's different. And every time you do something, even though the content might be the same, but the intent is different. And therefore, that's how you keep on going. Else it's going to get boring we're normal. We're humans. We're going to have some rougher times, and you know, sometimes it's going to be no matter what. Sometimes you get a harder patient, easy, that's going to be the norm. But within the norm, fundamentally, you have to view it. You can't be saying, like, if you view it, I'm doing the same thing every day, you're going to get bored, and then it's going to be much harder. It's a secret in life. If you enjoy what you're doing, time goes much quicker. If you don't like what you're doing, every day takes, you know, 48 hours instead of 24. So that's the idea over here. Solar and lunar. Everyone needs stability. You need a job. You need a place to sleep, eat. But that by itself, doesn't help. Like, as they say, for a monkey, if he eats bananas all day, then he might be happy. But a human being, we have both. We have our physical side, our spiritual side. So we need more than just going through the motions. We have to get excitement, and we have to find creativity. So that's why we go with the solar and the lunar. I'll quickly go through the Jewish holidays, at least some of them. We have many more Jewish holidays than Jewish fast days. But let's say we'll start with Passover. That happened about 2 months ago. That's the beginning of the Jewish nation. We were slaves in Egypt, and Moses got us out of the land of Egypt. We just celebrated last week. 7 weeks after Passover is the holiday of Shavuos. Shavuos means weeks. It's 7 weeks. We got the Bible at Mount Sinai. And then the next Jewish holiday will be in the fall also. It's called Sukkot. S-U-K-K-O-T. It's when we build huts outside. In other words, for 40 years when we left Mount Sinai until we got to the land of Israel, there was no Fortinos, no Shalom Village, there was no place to sleep or eat, it was a miraculous occurrence. God gave us food from heaven, water, and he protected us. So we want to show our gratitude to God, so we go outside for those 8 days and we eat our meals outside. So that's the holiday of Sukkot. And then before that, we have the Jewish New Year, as I mentioned. The Jewish New Year is a more serious time. It's a happy time, but it's Judgment Day. So we could be happy, but we have to be more serious. So basically, the Jewish New Year comes out in September, but it's the Jewish date is what counts. Why is the Jewish New Year come out on the day it does? What historically, what happened on the Jewish New Year? According to Jewish tradition, Adam and Eve were created. In other words, God created people. So what better time? God gets to rethink his choice if he made the right choice creating us. And therefore, it's Judgment Day on the whole world. So we start Rosh Hashanah, and we have 10 days of repentance. And Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is a fast day. That's when hopefully we get forgiven for all our mistakes and God, and then we start all over again. So, and then we go into Sukkot. So those are the biblical holidays. And then we have a couple of more, one's not a holiday, one's a very tragic, sad day. One is Holocaust Remembrance Day for what happened in Nazi Germany when the Germans killed 6 million Jews, among other things that happened other times. But that's, so we have a Remembrance Day for that. And then on a more happier occasion, we have in 1948, we got back the State of Israel. In fact, we celebrated year 75 this year. And in 1967, we got back Jerusalem. So those are different, more contemporary holidays. So those are just basics of how the Jewish calendar works. We combine the solar and lunar, and for everyone needs stability and everyone needs change. And a quick summary of the holidays. Any questions?
You didn't say Hanukkah, did you?
That is true. So, good point. I left out a couple of post-biblical. The two rabbinic holidays, Hanukkah and Purim. Hanukkah, people might have heard, not because they know anything about Hanukkah, because it comes out over Christmas a lot of times. They used to say Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah. I think now they do Happy Holidays. But Hanukkah, again, it comes out anywhere between the whole month of December, and basically, that was where the Syrian Greeks attacked the Jewish people. And they said, if you accept the Greek culture, we're okay with you. If not, we're going to kill you. So we didn't accept the culture. We fought back, and then so we celebrate. That's why we light a candle on Hanukkah, because it was a more spiritual celebration. Of course, we have donuts and other oily foods, because the miracle happened with the oil. So we have something called potato latkes, which are like potato pancakes, donuts, things with a lot of oil in them. Don't worry, no calories over Hanukkah if you eat them, so you're okay. And Purim is the other holiday, it's the Book of Esther. So we're also, the Persian king wanted to kill the Jewish people, and we were saved. That's a more physical holiday. So we celebrate, we read in the synagogue the Book of Esther, remember the miracle. Yeah, so those are the two major rabbinic holidays. As Dan's been here for a while, so he knows them, yeah. Any other questions on the holidays? Before we move on to kosher. Anyone know what kosher is? It says, Sholem Village is a kosher institution. I'll tell you what it's not. I'll tell you the mistake, what people think kosher is. Kosher, they tell me, is the rabbi blessing the food. If I bless the food, it's kosher. I wish it was that easy. That means I could find the pig, bless it, and eat it. Not that I want to eat a pig anyway, but in theory, I hear pork chops are okay, but I don't know. So obviously, it's nothing to do with kosher. It's true, we do have to make blessings every day. King David instituted that we make 100 blessings a day. Not to forget God, that we appreciate gratitude. So before I eat anything, the food belongs to God. So I have to make a blessing before I eat. And similarly, after we eat, we have to say grace after meals. We thank God for the food. In fact, that's the biblical mandate. We have grace after meals. Some have it before. But because that's when the danger is. When you're hungry, it's normal to turn. If you have no money, you're starving, and no one's helping you, who else are you going to turn to? God, because no one else. But when you're hungry, when you're full, you feel you don't need anyone. I'm okay. I'm satisfied. That's when you have to pray to God to realize that don't forget God even when you have good times. So nevertheless, so what is getting back? What is kosher? That's what kosher isn't. What is kosher? Kosher is a physical thing that you have to, number one, it has to be certain animals. In the book of Leviticus, it says, what's a kosher animal? Kosher is like a cow. What does a cow, sheep, and goat have in common? They chew its cud and has split hooves. So, in fact, the Muslims have similar, it's called halal meat, where it's not the same, but it's similar. In fact, if you're an observant Muslim and you can't find halal meat, you could eat kosher. It doesn't work. I can't eat halal meat because there are differences. In fact, I had a friend of mine who used to run halal meat. So I asked him how was business during Ramadan because the fasting for 30 days. He says business is great because they all have a party at night. So I guess they more than every night after they fast, they have a big get together. So it makes up for it. So either way, so you need chew its cud and split hooves. What are the signs of a kosher fish? What are the two signs for a kosher fish? Salmon, tuna, among others. It has to have fins and scales. If it has fins and scales, you're in. If it doesn't have fins and scales, you're out. And it's a big difference. When it comes to meat, let's say someone shot a cow and killed it. It's no longer kosher anymore. It has to go through a special slaughtering process. We do it to avoid, you know, the pain to the, you know, we're not allowed to, it's a biblical prohibition to cause pain even to animals, to anyone. So we do it in a way which is the least possible pain. And it goes through, you have to salt that. I mean, meat's probably salty in general, but kosher meat's even saltier because we salt the meat to get the blood out because the blood isn't kosher either. So therefore, we go through a whole long process. When it comes here, it's already, you just have to know how to put the spices on and the sauces. It already comes kosher. The hard part's done before it gets here. We just get it from the kosher butcher shop. So what happens is, so you have to go through a whole long process, but fish is much easier. If you're out up north somewhere or anywhere and you like fishing and you know how to fish, and you actually catch a salmon or you whatever, any, you just have to take it out and you can just eat it. Obviously, you'll do whatever you have to do, but there's no long process. So for a kosher fish, it needs fins and scales, and for meat, it needs, for the animal, it needs chew its cud and split hooves. For like chicken and for like birds, it's only a tradition. The Bible lists 24 birds that you can't eat, but we don't know exactly. That was like thousands of years ago it was written. So what they meant for that bird, there might be a different name. I'm not a bird expert, so therefore we just have to go with tradition. So chicken, duck, and other things we know are good. So that's the kosher physical part, as well as in addition to having kosher meat, we can't mix milk and meat together. That's why if you're down in the kitchen, you'll see it's separate kitchens. Like in there's a meat side, a milk side, or if it's the same side, we have to kosher it in between to use it. Because we can't, milk represents life. You milk the cow. Meat represents death. You slaughter it. So we want to keep life and death issues separate. So we don't mix, and I'm talking about kosher milk. In other words, I can't pour kosher milk into the chicken soup because that's mixing milk and meat together. It's also a biblical prohibition. Chicken and milk happens to be rabbinical, but red meat is like, but either the bottom line is we can't mix milk and meat together. And what's behind kosher? So the Bible just says, because you're a holy nation, you have to eat kosher. It doesn't really give us the reason. It's kind of like spiritual poison, that maybe physically I'll be fine if I eat non-kosher, but spiritually speaking, it'll have a bad effect. Again, only if you're Jewish, because if you're not Jewish, you don't have to eat kosher. It only have a bad effect on me. So, and that's why, of course, you could eat, you know, as long as you don't bring the food into the dining, you could bring food from home, you eat in the staff room, you could continue to, you're whatever your dietary needs are, you could continue on. So, except if you're in the kitchen in the certain area, so then you can't bring the food in. So what's behind kosher and really other things in general? There was a Stanford study, University of Stanford. It's nothing to do with kosher or Jewish. It's a big university in California, and they did a test. They called it the marshmallow test, but you could pick your own. What's your favorite treat? You could, was it? It might be chocolate chip cookies, brownies, ice cream, I don't know, whatever you like. Chocolate, you could fill in the blank. They did this study and they said, here's the deal, that we're gonna put a marshmallow in front of you. If you don't eat the marshmallow for 15 minutes, we'll give you a case of marshmallows. So they didn't know they were being watched. It was like one of those double windows where they, and so some people, the second they will walk in, how could the marshmallow, like, and they just downed it right away. Others waited a couple of minutes, then they saw no one looking, they started picking on the bottom of the marshmallow, some started licking the marshmallow, and some actually did not eat the marshmallow. So they did a study with permission, they weren't stalking them, over the next like 10, 20 years. These are younger kids. And they came to me, the obvious conclusion. What was the obvious conclusion? The people who were able to withhold the 15 minutes of temptation of not eating the marshmallow were much more successful in life than those who downed the marshmallow. Why? Because what's life all about? You're giving up immediate gratification for a long-term goal. Else you'd be sleeping now. You wouldn't be here. Who wants to get up for work? Who wants to... Because you know you need food, you need a place to live. Life is all about, you know, you can't spend all the money today, you put some away in savings, you want to support a family. Life is all about giving up. Of course, this time when you can give into gratification, you have your vacation or at night, whatever you're doing. But of course, there's time for both. But part of life in general is, that's what an animal does. An animal sees something and they just pounce on it. There is no self-control. But for a human being, God gave us the ability to show self-control, and that's what life's all about. So kosher is one of those. It's like when I'm traveling, you know, I can't go. It's hard. I mean, I'm used to it anyway now, but I know I can't just go into any place and eat. Even in Hamilton, come on in. Yeah. Even in Hamilton, we have more kosher now than when I got here, but it's not that much kosher. But say, I come from New York, where basically everything... If something wasn't kosher, I was surprised. I got to Hamilton and just about nothing was kosher. So I just, even if I didn't like it, I saw kosher cookies, I just got them. Now, it's much better now. And anyway, so to the point being, if I'm going on a trip, let's say I'm driving to New York where my family is, that's where I'm from. So I know if I better bring food with me, if I want to eat over the next 8 hours, I mean, the places I could stop, I have my kosher ice cream place, already know where I'm going, but the bottom line is you can't just go in and eat anywhere, etc. So that's kosher. That's milk and meat. We left out something that's parv, P-A-R-V-E. What's parv? I know Daniel knows, but it's something that's not meat and not milk. What's an example? Fruits, vegetables. So salads, fruits and vegetables you could have, let's say in the nursing home, usually breakfast and lunch is dairy, milk, and dinner is meat. So fruits and vegetables you could have every meal. It doesn't make a difference because they're parv. You know, if you use like a dairy utensil on it, or you put butter on it, or cheese, then you can no longer use it. But in its raw form, you could use it with anything. And fish is interesting, is parv. You can't have fish and meat together. We don't put fish and meat on the same plate, but that's why certain times you could have fish. I'm sure they must have fish sometimes at lunch, and they must have fish sometimes at night. I mean, because fish could go either way. You can, so therefore fish you could have for lunch, as well, you know, depends how you make it. So fish happens to be parv also. So that's it, and many of the products you'll see, like the potato chips, pretzels, a lot of stuff has a generic. So most, a lot of the stuff you're eating is probably kosher anyway without knowing it, but it's more like the meats and other things. But a lot of the generic things there'll be a kosher sign, different signs. One is like MK, not Michael Kors, Montreal Kosher, and the CORU, the different ones. So therefore, they're on the symbols, but everything that comes in here, you know, is kosher. That's a little bit on kosher. Any questions on kosher? And I said, in the staff rooms, you can eat whatever you want, but you can't use any of the Sholem Village, like, plates. You know, if you can use, you know, paper plates, and even not just you. Like, if it's going out of the kitchen, so generally speaking, we only use paper. Now that we do, because it's actually in the nursing home, because it's dangerous for different residents, so we have special dishes we use. We just go directly into the room of the resident, and then we take the food and take it out, because that's just a health issue, and we don't want part of being kosher is safety also. We don't want anyone choking on, like, the plates or the cups, so therefore we switch that up. One last topic is end of life. So we all know that human dignity, and is obviously when a resident is alive, so of course we do the utmost to keep them comfortable, out of pain, etc. But in Judaism, we also believe after one passes away, there's also honor to the dead, and we have to in a dignified way. So again, if it's a Jewish resident who passes away, so the you don't have to call them personally, but the nurse, whoever, they'll call the Jewish funeral home, and they'll make arrangements. So basically, for a Jewish patient, you just do the minimum. If he has to be cleaned a little, or like let's say, not that I usually have, but if it's connected and let's say there's blood on different things, you leave it because we bear part of the burial that if a person died with the blood, you know, came out, so therefore we bury that also. So the bottom line is you just have to do a minimum, and you basically cover the body, and basically they'll come and take care of it. We bring it to the Jewish funeral home where they prepare the body for the burial. And in Judaism, we go the quick, we try to do the burial as quick as possible. The quicker the burial, or I should say, the quicker the body decomposes, the quicker the atonement. In Israel, it's even quicker. They do same day. In Israel, they'll bury someone on the same day. And in fact, in Israel, is they bury them directly in the ground. Everyone's buried in a shroud, it's like a robe. Doesn't make a difference if you're a billionaire or you're afflicted with poverty. When it comes to death, we're all equal, and everyone gets buried the same way. And in Israel, you go directly in the ground. Why? Because the quicker the body decomposes, the quicker you get the atonement. In North America, we have rules we have to follow. The government says you gotta put coffins. So coffins isn't against Jewish law, it's just not the idea. So what do we do then? Because it says you should go from earth to earth. So if you're directly in the ground, you're doing it. So what we do is two things. We have earth from the land of Israel. We put it inside the coffin. So when the body's in there, it's touching the earth. And we make holes on the bottom of the coffin. So therefore, it's kind of like connected to the ground. So, and also I get the question, Rabbi, which coffin should I use? Should I spend? So I said, you know, like, because some of them could cost $30,000 or whatever. If they're made out of copper or gold, I say you use the simple wooden one, because really you shouldn't have any coffin. But what can we do? We got to have one, and wood decomposes quicker. So we go ahead and we put it in there. So therefore, that's the concept. We do it as quick as possible. Then we do our what we call Shiva, means seven. So then the person who loses one of the close relatives, father, mother, spouse, brother, sister, son, daughter, you have mourning for 7 days where you don't leave the house, and people come to you, and even psychologists say that's the best thing. Everyone needs to mourn. It's a human condition. You can either mourn right away, or can it hit you 7 weeks from now or 7 years from now? And you go, you talk about, you know, all the things about your loved one, etc. And then between 7 and 30 days, you get to leave. 7 days, you stay home, you don't go to work, it's full mourning, and then it's time to move on. The person will want to mourn all the time. We say, no, it's time, you have to move to the new normal, and you have to go on in life. That's for another 30 days or another 23 days. And only if you're a mother and father, so then you do a whole year. We only have one mommy and daddy, so they get 12 months. They get a whole year of mourning, and we don't go to, let's say, you don't go to concerts, you don't go to special like musical events. It's supposed to be a time where you're dampening your joy a little bit because you just lost your mother or father, or both. So then we always have throughout the year, we have Yizkor, which means to remember. We do things to remember our parents throughout the time. And 12 months later, what we do is, you can close the door if you don't want, thanks. For 12 months, within the next 12 months, we put up a monument. A monument is to show that even though the person passed away, but we're always going to remember them. And then we have customs going back throughout the year. We put a stone. If you've ever been to a Jewish cemetery, there's stones on top. Because why stones? Number one, because the Hebrew word for stone is the same word as God. So even though we can't be there 24/7, but God is watching you. And secondly, a stone is forever. It's permanent. Even though life is only temporary, but the legacy of our parents are forever on us. And therefore, no matter what, even though they're no longer alive, but as long as we continue in their traditions, learn, and we incorporate all the good things they taught us, so that can... they're considered living. As righteous people, even after they pass away, are considered alive. And then regarding a couple of more contemporary issues, what about autopsies? What's the Jewish view on autopsies? So all things being equal, we're against. We're not against autopsy per se. We're against autopsy because we consider that it's not honor to the dead. That by cutting up the body, it's not like, let me just go back a step. Regarding the funeral, we do it right away. But let's say the kids live out of town, far away, and it takes them a day or two to get here, so we wait. Because it's not honor to the dead to have a burial and no one's there. So we give time, so therefore the principle is always the same. Honor, we want to give the most honor to the dead, usually right away, but in cases like that, same thing here. Generally, if you're cutting up the body, it's not dignified. However, two exceptions to the rule. One, if the person is murdered. So if it's murdered, and the only way to put the murderer in behind bars is to do an autopsy. So we don't consider honor to the dead to let the murderer go out. Number one, you don't just murder one person. It's like, you know, the cockroach effect is never just one. So too, someone goes in, so therefore we want to protect society and honor to the dead. And also another case is, speaking of infectious diseases, someone walks into a hospital, they have no idea what it is and the person dies, and someone 5 minutes later walks in with the same symptoms. So we say you could do an autopsy to try to save the person. So to save human life, we do an autopsy or honor to the dead, but generally speaking, it's denigrating the dead. Again, as I like to say, maybe 10 years from now, we'll have it, the technology will be better. You could just stick a camera in, so then we're all pro. We're just against, if you could do it in a way which is still dignified, then it's okay to do an autopsy. It's more the fact that it's not a dignified way. What about organ transplants? What is the Jewish view on organ transplants? So it depends, there are different types of organ transplants. There's organ transplants when you're dead, and there are organ transplants when you're alive. So let's talk alive for a second. Could you donate a kidney to save someone else? So if you asked the question 60, 70 years ago, the answer was probably no. If you ask the question today, the answer is yes, and it's praiseworthy. You can't. It's not mandated. You are never obligated to give up a kidney. It's your choice, but if you want to, you can. What changed? Judaism hasn't changed, but technology has. 70 years ago, it probably wasn't going to be. You always have to weigh risk reward. How much danger to you versus how much you're saving some. So back then, the risk reward was not an end. It probably wouldn't work. You're putting yourself in danger. It wasn't a good idea. Today, technology is great. So again, so in fact, among percentage wise, Orthodox Jews are the highest donating people who donate organs in the world per percentage. So if you could save someone else's life, what better thing? And if you, and you don't, and let me just make it simple. You don't have to just donate in, donating an organ, a kidney is a big thing, but something which is less, is let's say donating blood, and you'll get your blood back. It regenerates, and you know, so those, so that's for sure is a big thing to do. Giving blood and maybe a bone marrow is a little more painful. Again, the, so none of these things are necessarily mandatory. Maybe giving blood, you know, could be, but the point is that so we're pro-life. And I know many people have given a kidney. What about signing the back of your driver's license to say, when I die, you take my body for science or whatever you want to do with it? So it sounds good in principle, but in practice, at least for Jewish people, is we don't recommend it. Why? Because unfortunately, like many systems, there's a lot of abuse going on, and you don't know what's actually going to happen to your organ. But I'll give more specific reasons why. Because the question is, can I donate an organ after I die? So let me get more specific. Can I do a heart transplant? Could I give my heart to save someone else? So the question is, why have organ transplants become so popular now? We've always had cemeteries. Why don't we go into a cemetery, take out the heart from dead people? I'm only kidding, because it wouldn't work. Obviously, you have to get a heart while it's still going. If you can't take a 10-year-old heart, it's not going to do anyone any good. So what happened was, when organ transplants became with technology, so therefore, so what's the issue? The issue is, so what is the best time to do, let's say, a heart transplant? Or is when the heart has to be pumping. If the heart's not pumping, it's not going to do any good. Is when what they call brain death. Or brain stem death, a little different. So the question is, what's the definition of death? So it was always assumed it was the heart. So I can't do it. How could I do a heart transplant? I'm a murderer. I'm taking your heart and giving it to someone else. And who says your life is worth more than anyone else's? In Judaism, you're not allowed to murder someone else to save someone else. Yeah. And so therefore, you have no... So. That's a big issue. So in Judaism, it's an unresolved debate today, what's the definition of death? So those rabbis who assume, and the state of Israel assumes this way, if it's brain stem death, which means you can no longer breathe anymore and it's not reversible, you are considered dead. Hence, there's no bigger, no greater deed. Save someone's life, why not? For those who are against it, they're only against it in practice because they assume this is... If your heart's beating, you're alive, so then you're a murderer. That's why no one's against it in principle. The question is, you have to define. So today, most assume like the brain death, but that's the debate in Judaism. That would be the debate if you could do it. But other organs where you're not going to, like giving skin, perhaps the cornea, of course we're pro. But the issue is, if you sign your license plate, they'll determine what death is. They're not going to ask you. So let's say I think it's the heart. But they don't care. Once you sign your license, they make the decisions, and then we still want burial done. They don't have to keep the body. So therefore, the bottom line is, which will be called, we have a Jewish donor society where you sign a card, or it doesn't have to be a card. You can write it in your will that basically speak to my rabbi, speak to my, and then whatever directions are, I'll tell you how and when you could do. So we're all in principle. We want to help as many people as we can. But it still has to be done in a proper way and not at the expense. So therefore, fundamentally, we're pro live kidney transplants. It's a tremendous thing, and donating blood. And in theory, it depends what your view is on what death is. If a person's dead, we say you could take the heart and the organ, but the issue is what's considered death. So those are some of the contemporary issues we have. You know, there's a lot more. We could spend a whole year on orientation, but... You only have 45 minutes, so we'll have to stop here. And feel free, you'll see me around, you'll ask any questions and stuff like that. Any questions now before...